So it's my pleasure today to introduce to you Carolyn Salzwedel. Carolyn was born in England and has been working as a painter and a printmaker in Hamburg since 1995. She studied modern languages at Durham, Oxford, and Bonn, and printmaking at the Ruskin School of Fine Arts in Oxford with Jean Lodge, who worked with the engraver and etcher Stanley William Hayter in Atelier 17 in Paris in the 1960s. So she stands in a descent from Hayter through her previous, or one of Hayter's students. In 1998, Carolyn founded the Hirundu Press as a vehicle for her artist books, which are printed in small editions. I first met Carolyn at the Frankfurt Book Fair in the year 2000, where we both exhibited in Stefan Barkowiak's then new book arts sector of the Frankfurt Book Fair. So this was an introductory way, nice way to meet somebody. I was immediately impressed with her what were called viscosity etchings, and the way that she entered her books as an artist, allowing the image-making process to erupt into the texts like a presence that was already there. In her artist statement, Carolyn has asked herself the question, what inspires an artist to make an artist book? And what makes this kind of art different from book illustration? Carolyn considers much of her work a dialogue with the author. Her new piece, a dialogue with Richard Wagner, is about fundamental issues that move us as artists, and an attempt to translate Wagnerian leitmotif into an image running through a book. The talk is titled The Red Line to Eve. So, Carolyn, where are you?
Here.
You're right here.
Speak into the microphone and loudly.
Okay. Hello, good morning. Can everybody hear me? Okay, friends, Romans, countrymen. Sorry, no orations. So the red line to Eve. I'm really, really happy to be here for the third time. I'm very happy that Peter has invited me to talk, and thank you so much for inviting me, and it's a real honor to be here. And okay, I'll just begin. So my first encounter with the artist's book was in the late 1980s in the printmaking department of the Ruskin School of Drawing in Oxford, when my tutor Jean Lodge invited Krishna Reddy to give a workshop. The two aspects that struck me most forcefully about the artist's book at the time was the interaction between media, in this case, the interaction between image and word, poetry and etching, and the dialogue, as Peter said, between the artist and the poet, which went far beyond illustration. In other words, I was thinking we have this theme of borders and collaborations. This has been on my mind for actually ever since I started thinking about making artist books as a sort of fundamental aspect of it. So the notions of making, of border crossing and collaborations were present at the very outset. Poems and images have always been closely related, and I knew that at some point in my life, I too would get to make an artist book of my own. I didn't know how it was going to be. I knew this is a sort of organic process, and it's got to mature. And maybe I'll never meet the right poet to do it, but maybe I will. And in the end, I actually did. So, the Hirundo Press first saw the light of day about 10 years later. The Hirundo... I'll go back one. The Hirundo rustica is the barn swallow, and it's a bird of passage, so crossing boundaries is in its nature. The first product was indeed a collaborative piece. The long poem Impossibility by Robert Crawford. There followed The Green Woman by Kathleen Jamie. And these are poems by a Scottish poet, both of them actually. Robert Crawford's also Scottish. And then two volumes in German by Kevin Perryman, and The Dancing Mouse by William Radice. All of these were first editions of the poems. And then there's another one that I didn't show, which is a very, very small collaboration that happened last year, or the year before, the year of the last codex. A local poet, Michael Rothenberg, whom some of you may know, came up to me and said, would you like to do a piece with me? And that's resulted in a little broadside, which is on my table. So you can come and have a look at that. And that's the most recent little collaboration. But dialogue can take place more abstractly. My fascination with James Joyce is one example. When the Hirunda Press was just starting, I made a large picture, a large print, entitled Bloomsday, featuring the letter Joyce wrote to Nora Barnacle the day before they first met, the 15th of June, 1904. And as you know, Bloomsday became the 16th of June. That was the day that they actually met and went out together. And very much later, when Ulysses came about and was published in 1922, fellow writer invited them to celebrate the 16th of June. And Nora asked Joyce, why the 16th of June of all days? And Joyce replied, because that's the day that the events in the novel take place. So he was rather pissed off. So before too long, I transported the hero of Joyce's novel. Leopold Bloom to Hamburg 100 years later. The parallels between Dublin and Hamburg are quite compelling. The work caught the. I'm sort of giving a brief summary of these. The work caught the attention of the collector of artists' books about Joyce, Leo Kunders, who asked me to make him a unique book about Joyce. He said he looked at this, and Hamburger Ulysses in Hamburg, and said, yeah, very nice, but I only collect unique books, so make me please one of a kind. And well, so I did. And it was this. I took the chapter Anna Livia Plurabelle from Finnegan's Wake, which is an extraordinary chapter. It's one of the only chapters that's actually translatable into any other language. And so I took the image of the Liffey, which wanders through the book and then becomes ever larger and ever darker as the day goes towards night and night falls, and the two washerwomen at the banks of the river turn into a tree and a stone, and at the end you're in the harbour and it's dark. And so I did that, and he was very pleased. So, however, there have been many other dialogues going on in my mind, and one that's been going on for some years now is with the work of music, and in this case with one of the greatest and also one of the most hijacked, misunderstood and abused works of the literature, Richard Wagner's Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg, The Master Singers of Nuremberg. You all know that it was Hitler's favourite opera, and it's a comedy that borders on tragedy at more than one moment. And not just in this respect has a Shakespearean grandeur to it. It's also, by the way, the only one of Wagner's mature works to observe the Aristotelian unities of time, place and action. It's a very long opera, but everything happens in one place and within 24 hours. It's actually such an extraordinary work that I feel that I'm a bit like I'm approaching Everest, but then mountains are there to be looked up at. So I lift my eyes onto the hills. There are many who wouldn't touch the work with a barge pole because of the way it was exploited by the Nazis. But I want to concentrate not on what it has meant to others or means to them now, but what it's telling me when I listen to the music. So incidentally, for those who don't know the work, I really would recommend you to listen to the piano transcription of the overture by Glenn Gould, which reveals this music as one of the masterpieces of counterpoint. It's absolutely fantastic. It's a very transparently played work. And it's, you know, some people think it's a sort of impossible to play Wagner on the piano, but Glenn Gould did it. Some people, I've heard it's been described as the greatest work of polyphonic music not written by J.S. Bach. So the pictures I'm about to show you, after a bit of a preamble, I confess, are of a work in progress. So actually, it's so much a work in progress, that's a very Joycean term actually. He used it for Finnegan's Wake for a long time. But I feel that I'm sort of at base one, going back to Everest. I feel that I'm just about at the beginning. I should finish it by the next codex. But the central image is taken from the pivotal monologue at the beginning of the third act, which is really a key to the whole work, and it's one of the things that you can hang the whole opera on. It's one of the central images. And Hans Sachs is reflecting on what happened, the events of the night before, and it's the beginning of the 24th of June, St. John's Day, and he's reflecting on what happened the night before, and he says, Wahn, Wahn, überall Wahn, madness, madness everywhere. This is a plate for the first print, and there are going to be 9 prints in all, and it's going to be a Leporello idea, and the text comes at the end. And I haven't finished the typography yet, so it's going to be a fairly elaborate piece. But it's all you see here, it's a collograph. It's and it's made of cardboard and. With various things stuck onto it or dug out of it, and and then sealed. So you can use it as it's like an intaglio plate. So that's the first letter of the word Wahn. It's a very slippery word. It's not the same as insanity, which is Wahnsinn, but it actually includes most of the English connotations of madness. So I'm using the word madness as a shortcut. It can mean delusion. The German title of Richard Dawkins' polemic is Der Gotteswahn. And it can mean an idée fixe. It can mean obsession. It can mean a loony idea. It can mean a forlorn dream. It can mean just a mistake. Yeah. It can mean an imagination. So it's used, in fact, it's transformed in the course of this work. It's always something, it's always somehow connected to ideas, whether they be brilliant or mistaken. It's, in the course of the work, it becomes a kind of, in the course of my work, it's become a sort of idée fixe too. So in the last 2 weeks, in fact, it's been popping up everywhere in the daily press. So here, in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, this is about the 10th anniversary of Wikipedia, and dictionary making is described as Werke des Wahns. You have to be crazy to make a dictionary. Yeah? The review of Black Swan in the Frankfurt Allgemeine is Der Wahn vom Schwan. And a special report on the German railways, and Bahn AG is in Die Zeit. Yeah. Wagner uses the word in multiple senses. Here you see the first lines of the monologue with the word highlighted in red. It's not going to be highlighted in red in the actual thing. But this gives you an idea of the typography anyway. It's the Garamond. So it can mean a crazy idea. Meisterwahn is used to denote the hopeless dream of becoming a master. It can mean the error, as I said, the town scribe Beckmesser accusing Hans Sachs of playing foul, is told, "Mein Freund, ihr seid im argen Wahn." You're on totally the wrong track here. And used as a verb, wähnen, you can see in the last line, it means to imagine falsely. And so what actually happened the previous night? I'm finally getting there. So just to recap, the Meistersinger von Nuremberg is set in 1550, middle of the 16th century. So we've just passed the Reformation, we're in the wake of the Reformation, which is in the wake of course, Gutenberg. So, and so this is a revolution that's just happened, which has swept through the country, and we suddenly have the prince's word, which is very important. And our first view of the main female character, Eve. So I've finally got there. She's the goldsmith's daughter. Is the object of her father's artistic ambition. He wants her. He wants to see her married to the best bard in the city, and initiates a competition which only master singers can enter. Eva is at the centre of three men's attention. She's in love with a real poet, the young nobleman Walter. So, there he is. Whose chances of becoming a master are thwarted in Act One. And she now faces the prospect of being hitched to the pedantic critic, Beckmesser, whom she loathes, and or if she refuses him, and there are not too many eligible men in this elite group. If she ditches him, then she faces the prospect of a single life, which is not too hot. Then the third one is Hans Sachs, the shoemaker, who is a sort of fatherly figure. She goes to him for advice, and she hopes that he will be able to tell her, yes, Walter is eligible. He can join the competition. Yeah, she's told the opposite. And so she's in desperation. They decide that they will elope that very evening. And Hans Sachs notices what's in the air and creates a noisy stir that brings all the neighbours out onto the streets and in protest. And so a riot starts. And this renders Walter's and Eva's flight impossible. It's this chaos, this wahn, that's the focus of Sachs's reflections. So the fascinating thing is that the character of wahn changes both in Hans Sachs's monologue and in the course of the opera. Wahn is an irrational and dangerous energy which cannot be dismissed lightly. It's a sleeping monster, but it also contains the potential for creativity and the power to inspire. The notion of wahn as energy was central to my interpretation, the red line. I took the image of the red line, the guiding principle of Wagnerian leitmotif, which is also present in one of my depictions of the elements. Here's fire as energy. And the red line here, the red line in this one, leads us through the work. So we begin at the beginning. Wherever I look in the chronicles of the city or the world, all I see is wahn. I don't know whether Didier is here. Is Didier here? yesterday he showed you a picture that he said, that shouldn't be there, that shouldn't be there. Well, Didier, if you're here. Yeah, hi. Merci. C'était parfait. Because that was, what he showed you was the Nuremberg Chronicles. And the Nuremberg Chronicles is what Hans Sachs is referring to. Whenever I look, wherever I look in the city, in the chronicles of the city or the world, that's all I see. Where does this chronicle begin? It begins at Genesis. And this is the subject of Hans Sachs's raucous song the previous evening, where he says, when Eve was thrown out of paradise by the Lord God Almighty, and so on, and so on, and so on. And it's a shoemaker's song, and how Eve was lacking shoes, and so God sent his angel to make her shoes. We have at the bottom you see on the left hand side you see the A and E, which are part of the word Eva, the name. And they could also be Adam and Eve. So this is Schedel's Weltchronik, and so that's where he begins. And Eva, at that point, listening, she's hiding with Walter in the shade of a tree, and she thinks he's getting at me, which was true, of course. So Hans Sachs' monologue runs as follows. Here's a very rough and slightly abridged English translation. Madness, madness everywhere. Wherever I look, in the chronicles of the city or of the world, that's all I see. What is it makes people leap at one another's throats? Nobody gains anything from it. A man imagines himself in pursuit when in reality he's on the run. Who can put a name to it? It's that old monster, madness, whose shadows are every move and informs every action. Should things quieten down, he's just taking a nap to gather strength. He'll wake at any moment, and then who will be able to master him? Look at my dear old Nuremberg, set in the heart of Germany, the model of sober good manners and sober living. Yet one evening, to prevent two hot-headed young people creating a disaster, one man at his wit's end seizes the thread of madness and tugs at it, and watches the whole town erupt in tumult. God only knows how that happened. Some sprite must have been at work there. A firefly was missing his mate. Well, the scent of the lilac went to my head. St. John's Eve. It's the magical Midsummer Night, which is another parallel with Shakespeare. We've had a wonderful talk on Shakespeare this week. I had to think of that. But now, St. John's Day has dawned. And now, let's see what Hans Sachs can do to guide the madness to a nobler end, for if it cannot be tamed, even here in Nuremberg, it will ruin our best work, which can seldom be achieved in the run of the mill, and never without a trace of madness. I'll run through those images once more, so I follow the message of Hans Sachs's monologue in the first six. So the first reflects the original Wahn that caused the two Adam and Eve being cast from paradise. The second carries the word forward and the line. The third indicates the triangular conundrum. Now you have the three letters in a very pointed variation, so to speak, E, V, and A. And then comes the action of Act Two, with the chaos resulting from Hans Sachs's tug on the red line and his perplexity afterwards. And the rest of the third act brings the necessary resolution and the creation of Walter's prize song, which is the result of a wonderful discussion between Walter and Sachs on poetry, and this is an inspired explanation by Sachs of the rules of the Meisterlied, the master song, prize song. So the poet's truest imagining, des Dichters wahrster Wahn, is revealed to him in his dreams. And this is where Wagner is at his most autobiographical. It's his own music he's writing about. The song itself is given three renditions. You'll have noticed the number three also figures prominently in this work. Each song also has three stanzas, and each of the stanzas has three sections. It's like the three strophe, antistrophe, and epode. Yeah. The song is given three renditions. The first is the perfect exam piece composed by Walter under Sachs's tuition, and the second, Beckmesser's woeful distortion of it, and the third, the transcendently lovely prize-winning song in which Eva becomes not only the muse but also the quintessential Eve in a regained paradise. The name, too, is here transformed and reversed from Eva to Ave, which is normally reserved for the Virgin Mary, or, of course, for Caesar. The German word Heil was, of course, a word of Unheil, we would say in Germany. It was 70 years later, was practically destroyed. So the serpent has bitten its own tail, and the wheel has come full circle. Well, our rational modern minds know paradise is impossible, and we're sceptical about the sublime, which tends to vanish as soon as we approach it. But should we ever catch a glimpse of it, we desire it for ourselves. Perhaps that's one of the reasons for making art at all. And I thought, in a country where everything is proverbially possible, it's a good place to give this piece of madness a first airing. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.